Welcome to the Dharma Talk. The theme this afternoon is the ending of attachment to me and mine. I'm just wondering if we could have a Hebrew translation of the title, the ending of attachment to me and mine. Thank you. So I'm going to try to take this step by step. But essentially the talk is rather a lot about self and not self, which is one of the Buddha's rather difficult themes to understand. The conventional and ordinary way of seeing the world and experiencing it is through the mechanism of self, or I. We tend to think that there's a me acting in the world to which many things happen. But in our Dharma practice, we're invited to explore this assumption. The focus of the Buddha's teachings is always on that which we can immediately experience. The teachings are not speculative. They're to be directly understood and realized through practice. So it's through the direct contact through the sense doors, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking, that our suffering is born. And it's here too that we find the end of suffering. So this is why in our practice we ask you to pay attention to the feelings, the sensations, the perceptions, the thoughts, all that's occurring as you sit. If there's a strong emotion, we just see that as it is. So as we begin to look more closely at our experience, that which we perceive and are conscious of, we start to notice that there is nothing we can find that is actually a me. There's nothing that is a self or belongs to a self. Instead, what we notice are the shifting, changing sensations. Our feelings, our thoughts, our ideas, they're very elusive. They're like the weather. They just come, go, change, shift. They have no solidity. The self is empty of any solid existence or inherent existence. And hopefully by the end of the talk, you will actually understand that. So Thailand's great teacher of emptiness, Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of my teachers, and one of Christopher Titmus's teachers too, he says this: in the most fundamental sense, emptiness simply means emptiness of the attachment to me and mine. He goes on to say, the mind will simply be a mind, so he means heart and mind, the mind will simply be a mind in its natural state, free from attachment and ignorance, because it has seen the emptiness of all things. So you see, self is naturally not self. We're not trying to cancel out or negate the idea of self, but rather see the quality that self has. When one sees the emptiness of me and mine, the insubstantial nature, and I mean, it's true, isn't it? We're not the same for a second. 1 minute we feel one way, and 5 minutes later we feel a different way. 1 minute we love ourselves, and the next minute we think we're just terrible and hopeless. So our feelings are totally unreliable. Our idea of who we are is also totally unreliable. We're generally deluded in who we think we are, and how we are, and how we'd like to be. We invent, if you like, this construction of self, of me. And we make it such a problem for ourselves because we don't live up to our ideal self. We measure ourselves. We like parts of ourselves and not other parts. And so we have an inner war that goes on. There's extraordinary turbulence that occurs in the heart and mind. So when we really see this just as it is, the insubstantial nature of me and mine, then we touch into a luminous, free way of being. The heart is naturally already free. We don't have to make it different. We just have to get out of our own way so that we see clearly what is actually here, what is actually present, what we can know directly. And as soon as we realize this, there's quite a revolutionary release. It's such a relief to see that we don't have to modify ourselves. We simply have to see that the entire structure of the self is fabricated. It's put together. And it has no substance. And when we see this, then the self has very little hold over us. We can, of course, use the language of self, but hold the idea and notion of me rather lightly. Nisargadatta Maharaj, one of the great teachers from the last century in India, he's the Bidiwala Baba. He made bidis, which are little Indian cigarettes, and sold them. That was his business. And upstairs in his bedroom, he held satsang. And he's written a rather famous book called, well, somebody else has put it together. It's a book of the dialogues that he had with people, and it's called I Am That. And many of you will have seen it, but most of you will not have been able to understand it. In it, he says this: when you do not think yourself to be this or that, all conflict ceases. So I'll say that again. When you do not think yourself to be this or that, all conflict ceases. So when we don't fix on an idea and say, this is me, I am this, I am like this, we have the capacity to be with ourselves or be with life just as it is. We generally think we have a self, and that this self is inadequate, unlovable, not good enough. Or we're rather narcissistic, and we go to the other extreme and we think we're so fabulous. We're completely right. We know how to do everything better than anybody else. And we can be quite arrogant with that. So we either diminish ourselves or elevate ourselves. We rarely see ourselves as we actually are. So whichever tendency you have, please don't take yourself seriously. Relax. It's okay. In Pali, there's a word for this way of forming the self. And Ajahn Buddhadasa, the famous teacher I was talking about, speaks about it. The Pali word is atamayata, and it means not made up or uncompounded or not put together by anything. So unfabricated. So when we start to see that the self doesn't have solidity, we can then end our attachment to the self, we loosen our grip on that, and then we soften into the knowing of that which is not put together by anything. So when we start to listen in our meditation sittings to our direct experience of that which is not bound up with self, we start to see in a rather different way. And this is the teaching, the profound teaching of the Buddha. And of course, those words I used, the uncompounded, the unconstructed, and the unfabricated, and also the notion of emptiness are words the Buddha used to describe liberation or freedom. Now, just a note on emptiness. Emptiness, of course, doesn't mean any kind of vacuous state or barrenness or the kind of emptiness that comes with depression. It simply means emptiness of intrinsic existence, that the self doesn't exist in and of itself. So we keep on coming back in our practice to our direct experience. And we see how we link our idea of I and my to the parts of us that make up a person. And the Buddha called these, he labeled five different areas or bundles or heaps, he called them aggregates, that make us up. So the eye can land on form. So form is the body, or form are the objects of the world. It can land in the feeling world, perception, mental formation, so what we think about, and in consciousness. And our relationship to these areas of life determines what kind of person we are. You might be the kind of person where the eye lands a lot on the body, and you're exceedingly worried about how you look. Or perhaps you have a fear of death, which is related to the belief, I am the body. On the other hand, you might be a rather intellectual person, so the eye lands in the world of thought rather often. This is your tendency. Or it might be that you're rather an emotional person, and so the eye lands in the feeling and emotional world. Lands and clings. That's the important point. Because, of course, the sense of I can just arise anyway and be rather light and free. We know we have a body, but we don't have to be too distressed about it, and so on. So the process that we are engaged in, day out, that somehow skips our attention, is that we identify and make mine or appropriate that which is not ours. So we overlay organic life, the reality, with our tendency to cling either to form, feeling, perception, mental formations or consciousness. Now I'm going to say a little bit about those now, tell a couple of stories so that you perhaps might understand what I mean. The teaching is that there is no entity that stands apart from those five things, the aggregates. There's no separate entity that is me or you. Neither are the thoughts and feelings happening to a separate entity. Because sometimes that's what we think. We think everything in the world is happening to us. And nor are our sensations, perceptions, feelings, and thoughts owned by the entity. You see, this process of identification and clingings slips and slides around and is rather subtle. So we have to be quite sharp about what's to see what's really going on within us. Because the sense of I can land on, I am the observer, for example. It can land on, I am aware. Water. So coming back to the first, which is form. We've all had the experience of clinging to the body. The body is not the only form, obviously. There's all the forms in the world. But generally, we cling to this is me. So sometimes we say we're in the body. Sometimes we say I am the body. Or this body is mine. We view the body as a possession. Or sometimes we have some fantastic experiences where we're out of the body. Some of those are drug-induced. But they're a wonderful meditation experience. So the I lands on, I am the body. So now you're going to hear confessions of a Dharma teacher. So that you can understand, I'm going to tell you about an experience from my life. Now, it's a little trivial, but I think it will make the point, and it makes an important point, actually. A few years ago, now, one of my sons, my eldest son, was getting married. And the wedding was on a beautiful beach in the afternoon. And then in the evening, there was a much more formal dinner. And so, of course, being mother of the groom, I decided that I just had to look fabulous that night. But of course, I went into the what to wear crisis. You can't wear black to a wedding in Australia because it's what you wear to funerals. You can't wear white because the bride's wearing white, and that was 90% of my wardrobe. So my daughter, bless her heart, said, Mom, let's go shopping. We'll find you a dress. So we found this beautiful, it's pretty nice, orange satin long dress. I wasn't sure about it. I didn't think it was terribly flattering, but my daughter said, yes, Mum, it's good, it's good. But then, when we got home, she said, Mum, you need granny pants. I said, granny pants? So a granny is like a grandmother. And she said, granny pants. I said, what are you talking about? I've never heard of such a thing. She went on to explain that they're underwear. I can't believe I'm talking about underwear in a Dharma talk, but anyway, they're underwear that's rather elastic, and they go from down here up to about here, making the body rather slim and smooth. She said, Mum, that's what you need. And I just went, no way, that's absurd. I said, I'm not the grandmother of the groom, I'm the mother of the groom. I'm not up to that yet. But of course, when the day came, vanity prevailed, and I had a quick trip to the underwear shop, and it was lucky, actually, because it was a really windy day and a satin dress would not have looked good without the underwear. So don't you hate it when your children tell the truth? And they say, okay, this is what you need to do. So this is a silly example, really, of I landing on the body. But the fact is, how many of you in the room are really comfortable with how your body is, the shape of the body, the age of the body, the changes in the body, the health of the body. And the sense of I and the wanting to be different, you know, lands on the form. And for some, it's a very painful experience because we think we're not beautiful enough or not tall enough, short enough, pretty enough, handsome enough, strong enough, muscled up enough, or whatever it is. So it's, while I'm making light of it, it actually can be a rather serious form of suffering for some people. So this is I that lands in the world of form. An I, of course, can also land on other things, like I am a woman, I'm a mother, I'm a father, I'm a son. These are all the roles, or perhaps our occupation. I'm an artist, I'm a gardener, I'm a psychologist, and so on. This is the I forming something that we view as solid about who we are. And of course, we're not that. That's just what we do. So we hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. This is contact. Dependent upon contact arises feeling. And it's not feeling like an emotion, it's feeling the feeling tone of the experience, which is pleasant, unpleasant, or in between. And of course, when we have a pleasant feeling, desire arises and we run after it, after that object, person, thing. We like something. When we have an unpleasant feeling, we tend to avoid or push away the person, the thing, or the experience. And so this process is going on day in, day out, and we have to unhook the linking of ourselves to it and just see it as an unfolding process that happens for all of us. So we don't take it personally. It's not a personal process. It's just a mechanism that comes about for every single person who's born. So if we do get caught up and identify with the self, we see the world dualistically. So we say, this is me and the world is there. This is me and you are there. Dharma teaches us to see in a different way, to see the end of that dualistic way of being and relating to the world. And of course, it promises something much more connected and much more beautiful, much more peaceful without the pain. When we feel separate, what we feel is, of course, isolated, alienated, anxious, or discontent. We human beings like to feel connected. All anxiety, all anger relies on a separate sense of self. In fact, all suffering, we could say, relies on that. So, let's come to perceiving. To perceive is I see. So there's the perceiver. We construct the one who is seeing. And the instruction is to just see, just hear, without the addition of the one who is doing it, the self. For example, with the breath. I remember last year somebody said here, it's not as if I am breathing, but the breath is breathing me, if you like. So it's just that slight shift in the way of looking at what is happening. So our non-dual perception, our perception that isn't two, is to see without the division of perceiver and perceived. And perception, a story just came to mind, so I'll tell you. My friend Dominica was managing the Bodh Gaya retreats for many years in India. And in those days, we had just little kutis, little huts to sleep in. And she had a tiny little bed and her mosquito net, and she was tucked up in bed in the middle of the night. And she woke, and she felt something next to her in bed. It was about this round. It was quite long and a bit fat next to her in the middle of the night, in the dark. Her thought was, it's a snake. It's a snake. There's a snake in my bed. So she immediately tried to find her torch, turned the torch on eventually, and then the realization dawned. Of course, it wasn't a snake. The long, round, fat thing next to her was her own arm. She had been sleeping on her arm and it had gone totally numb. And so she couldn't feel with her arm that her arm was next to her body. But she could feel with her body that the arm was there and it didn't feel like anything that belonged to her. So immediately, of course, the mind went, it's a snake in bed with me. Okay, so this is perception. It's not the reality, but we perceive in a certain way, and perception is more often than not distorted. So the next of the aggregates is mental formations. Mental formations include what we think, our views and opinions of our relationship to the world. And there's a rather wonderful teaching story from the Sufi tradition about the wise fool Nasruddin. And the story goes like this. The Mullah Nasruddin was sitting in a tea shop when a friend came in excitedly to speak to him. "I'm about to get married, Mullah," his friend stated, "and I'm very excited." "Mullah, have you ever thought of marriage yourself?" Nasruddin replied, "I did think of getting married. In my youth, in fact, I very much wanted to do so. I waited to find for myself the perfect wife. I traveled looking for her, first to Damascus. There I met a beautiful woman who was gracious, kind, and deeply spiritual. But she had no worldly knowledge. I traveled further to Isfahan. There I met a woman who was both spiritual and worldly, beautiful in many ways, but we did not communicate well. Finally, I went to Cairo, and there, after much searching, I found her. She was spiritually deep and graceful and beautiful in every respect, at home in the world and at home in the realms beyond it. I felt I had found the perfect wife." His friend questioned further, "Then did you not marry her, Mullah?" "Alas," said Nasruddin as he shook his head, "she was unfortunately waiting for the perfect husband." But you see, don't we do this? We look and imagine that we're going to find the perfect person who's going to make us content and happy. And we look for happiness outwardly. Or we look inwardly and we think we're unworthy, or we give up on relationships and say, "I'm really bad at relationships. I think I'm over it." In the first retreat, we had someone 33 years old who was saying, "I think I'm over relationships now." So the criticism, the negativity, either lands outwardly or inwardly. And this is the movement of the mind. And nothing is ever good enough. no one outside is good enough and we're not good enough inwardly is a very common theme. And I do know that some of you are in wonderful long-term relationships, but my experience of this realm hasn't been quite that. It's been, you know, a much more turbulent time. So the I, of course, lands in our judgments. Or the I lands with some negativity, and this needs to be seen. The I can also land on consciousness, and when it lands in consciousness, it lands in the knowing quality of mind. So consciousness sees, consciousness hears, consciousness says, I know. And even with consciousness, although it's pretty much the same for all of us, we're conscious of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching and thinking, but even there, we get a little grandiose and we think, I am infinite, you know? I don't want to be the plain little old me, but I'd like to be cosmic consciousness, thank you. I'd like to know that which is vast and immeasurable. So we can be a little grandiose, even with consciousness. And the I can cling and land and say, oh, I am so aware, and so on. I'm so enlightened is another variation on that theme. So how does this notion of not self or emptiness of self work in our daily life? So let me give you an example from my counseling work. One day I work as a psychologist. I did work, as I'm now retired, but I did work as a psychologist in Australia for 26 years. So a doctor in the town where I live called me and said, Radha, I really need a favor. I want you to see a patient of mine who's suffering from depression. And so I said, yes, tell me more. And she said, the complicating factor in the person coming for counseling is that she's profoundly deaf. And not only is she deaf, but she can't speak very much at all. And so it was quite a challenging situation. And she said, I really, really want you to see her. She said she can write. She's been educated a little and she can write very simple things. And you can pass notes back and forth, or you can have a translator who does sign language. We call in Australia the sign language for those who are deaf is called Auslan. And so in the first session, we had an interpreter who did the sign language, but my client, the woman, was not very happy with her. She didn't want somebody else there. She wanted to talk to me with just me there. So in the next session, there were just the two of us. So I had to find a way of relating. So the notes were passed back and forth, and I heard a little about her story. And I won't go into the details of what had happened to her, but she said to me, I'm so lonely. No one talks to me. I cry all the time. I want to die. And my heart just broke for her because she lived in this very silent world with very little communication from anybody. And it was challenging to meet her. And so I didn't quite know what to do. And so I reflected on it. And I realized, of course, that there was an extraordinary gulf between us in that I was the psychologist and she had the expectation that somehow I was going to fix her life. And I, as the psychologist, was in the role of trying to improve something in her life or lessen her suffering. And so the I, of course, is landing for each of us in different places. And of course, any barrier like this gets in the way of a really authentic meeting. So of course, I saw that I actually needed to let go of the role of psychologist and really, if you like, just be totally myself. And in Australia, I don't know about here, but there's a code of ethics for psychologists. You're not encouraged to touch people. You can touch people, but you're certainly not encouraged to. You're not encouraged to be friends with clients or socialize with clients. But still, I really felt like I needed to do something. And so when she arrived at my house, I would welcome her and hug her and kiss her. And I would make her tea and treat her just like I would treat a friend. Her doctor did the same. And then I began to understand how much she was locked in a world of isolation. So I said, look, let's go for coffee. Let's go downtown. And when I walked with her down the street, I really realized what her life was like. Because in some hours that we were there together, only one person spoke to her. She could understand what people said, but she couldn't respond very well. So I thought, well, it didn't work very well going out with her. What will I do? And then one day she came and she brought a photograph. And the photograph was of her children. She had two children. And so I said, oh, I have four children. And so I opened my computer and I began, by this time I was like, well, let's throw caution to the wind in terms of thinking, I'm supposed to be some clinical psychologist here. And so I opened my computer and I showed her pictures of my family and my children. I showed her pictures of India. And she was so curious, and I discovered she was really bright and intelligent and interested and funny. And she just loved to hear what I did and why I did it. And as best I could, I explained what I did in terms of teaching retreats. So in the ordinariness of just dropping those barriers, dropping the roles, there's a sense of healing, and really it's love. Love is the great healer. So when we drop our attachment to the identity, whatever it is, the role that we're acting in, the way we see ourselves, when we just let go of that, there can be a really authentic meeting between two people, even if we can't talk much, and even if we come from vastly different backgrounds. So in the meeting of just one human being with another, there is no self or not self, not me. There's no other. And there's nothing at all to claim as mine. There's just that extraordinary being and connection with another. That meeting in the heart of emptiness. It's a meeting of hearts. So to understand the Dharma involves the cessation, the ceasing of clinging to any role. It involves letting go of how we see ourselves, how we'd like to be, and that huge gulf between the two. It involves letting go of the judgments of others. It involves just a slightly, or maybe it's a dramatically different way of seeing the world. So we no longer see ourselves as separate from this existence. That is the key. Our separation supports our suffering. Our separation is our suffering. In our practice, we are also invited to be with our suffering, to be with that which is painful, that which is difficult. So we're not asking you to deny it or making light of it. And sometimes from being with the most difficult things in life comes our greatest realizations. So from the tragic, from the painful, from the difficult, where we are utterly forced to let go because we have no choice, can come sometimes our deepest insights. And I want to share another story from my life. Some of you will have heard it, but my little grandson, quite a number of years ago now, died from a brain tumor. He was 5 months old when he was diagnosed with a brain tumor at the base of his brain. He one day had a stiff neck and couldn't straighten his head. And of course, he had all kinds of treatment and all kinds of alternative things and all kinds of surgery and chemotherapy and some fairly, you know, radical kinds of treatment in the hope that he would live. But when he was about 18 months old, the doctors said there really is nothing that can be done and he will die. And so it was a matter of just being with this child. And so we held him day and night for 2 months before he died. We all took turns in the family. And he was such a beautiful boy. We just adored him. His name was Finn. And one day, after I'd received this terrible news that there was nothing that could be done, he crawled over to me. I was sitting on a rug on the floor. And I was feeling pretty low because we just received the news that he would die. And I was really feeling for my son and my daughter-in-law, who were just the most amazing parents with him. And so Finn, the little baby, crawled over to me, sat up on my lap, and turned his head like that, and put his head on my heart. And he just stayed there for like 3 or 4 minutes, this tiny child putting his head on my heart. And it was like, oh my goodness. And everybody stopped and noticed because it was such an unusual thing for a baby to do. And so I held his head with my hand and it was as if he wanted to comfort me. And as I held his head on my heart and he just sat there really, really quietly, everything just fell away. All sense of I am the grandmother and this is the grandchild and my grandchild is dying just fell away. And there was just love itself. There was the love that he was expressing towards me and the love that I very obviously had and still have for him. So when we are really with our suffering, when we are really with things as they are, from our deepest, most difficult times can come extraordinary and profound understanding. So when we really let go, we let go into freedom, or we let go into that which is not a form, it's formless. And in that letting go, we see the emptiness of self and the emptiness of all things. And that emptiness is understood as love. It's understood as care. It's the great capacity our human heart has to see the humanity in the other and to know that which is untouched by death. Because that love doesn't cease with death, that love is. It's vast, it's immeasurable, it's deathless, the Buddha called it. And this is the deathless teaching of the Buddha. When we really look, when we really look and see into our lives, the very events of our lives without clinging, we see that which is formless and boundless and totally full of love, empty of self and totally full of love. Let's just sit together for a few minutes. May all beings see deeply into the events of life. May all beings let go of clinging to self. And may all beings live with love.